Okay, good morning. I'd like to please ask that you silence your phones. Give you a second for that. Today is Thursday, April 11th, 2019. This panel is number 3203, entitled Global Trade Wars. I'm sure if you've been to many panels already, you know that we'll be utilizing both the CWA app and note card system. We have two producers in the room. Ladies, can you put your hands up so they can see you? They're in the back of the room. And I'll probably ask one of them to come up front so you can see hands a little better, if one of you could come up front. And this is Linda Foreman and Alice Garcia. And thank you both for being here to help us. So if you have any questions that you'd like to put on the card, please do, or please utilize the app. You may also raise your hand and you'll get a note card. And I'd like to say, if there are students attending, they take first right on the questions, and also on the app, and also on the index cards. And if you could please make your questions brief and to the point, it will help us a lot. All right, my name is Kenna Quiller, and I am co-chair of the International Affairs Committee for the Conference on World Affairs. It's a pleasure to get to know these wonderful speakers that we bring in, and their expertise, I think, as you found out, is just next to none. So we are so happy that they are here with us. I'd like to take just a brief minute to introduce each one before we start the panel. To my left here is John Haveman. I didn't even ask him how to pronounce his last name first. John Haveman. Had a chance to get to know him a little bit last night. He is widely considered to be one of California's leading experts on the economics of seaports, goods movements, and international trade policy. He also is an expert in regional economies and local economic development. He has been quoted in numerous periodicals and is frequently interviewed on radio, television, and has testified at numerous federal and state government hearings. We're so fortunate to have him here. Through his experience as a speaker, Haveman has recognized the benefits of economic literacy in informing national policy. So important. This dedication to outreach by professional economists has developed his vision for the National Economic Education Delegation, NEED, a nonprofit of which he is executive director. I also found out how he kind of keeps his mind clear so he can keep all these numbers in his head. He's an Iron Man, so he fits right into our Boulder crowd, absolutely. So welcome. We're very happy to have you here, John. Next, we are so blessed and happy to have Ambassador Ross Wilson and his wife, Margot Squires, so you've probably seen her on some of the panels as well. Ambassador Wilson is a distinguished senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and visiting lecturer in international affairs at George Washington University. Over his 30-year career in the U.S. Foreign Service, Ambassador Wilson has been an ambassador and worked in numerous countries, including Turkey, Moscow, Prague, and Melbourne, Australia, as general consul. Currently, he's on assignment at the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, and we are so blessed. I think he's come the furthest. I don't know. We can figure that out later. But we're so blessed it worked into his schedule to be able to join us. He is also chief U.S. negotiator for the Free Trade Area of the Americas, and he can explain a little bit more about that to you. So welcome, Ambassador Wilson. And last but not least, down at the end here, we have Nancy Donaldson. And Nancy served from 2010 to 2017 as director of the Washington Office of the International Labor Organization. And that is a specialized agency for United Nations. She also has advised governments, nonprofits, labor unions, and corporations on government and public affairs for over 25 years. She has a law degree from Emory University, and her focus, and she can tell you more about this, is going to be on social impacts of global trade and globalization, which is such an important perspective that we look at in this picture. The other thing about her, and I was so impressed because I have a new knee from it's just 2 years old, is that Nancy has two 3D printed knees. That's going to be interesting to hear a little more about that if you don't know. My knee wasn't made on a printer, but evidently she has two that were. So we'd like to welcome Nancy for joining us. Now I'd like to give each speaker 5 or so minutes just to talk a little deeper about their background and how they see the trade wars globally are affecting and impacting us. John?
Thanks very much. I'm happy to lead off, but before I do, I want to do two things. One is to thank the CWA for having me here. This is my first year at this conference, and I think it's absolutely fabulous. The second is, can I take a show of hands? How many of you were at the previous session on trade policy? Okay, quite a few of you. All right. Well, as I was sitting there, I was reminded, I'm going to make a couple of cultural references that will show my age a little bit. I'm reminded of a Dick Van Dyke show where he was to give, I think, an acceptance speech. And he stood up to give his, well, he was sitting in the audience while the previous person was giving their acceptance speech, and it turned out to be exactly the same one that he had written. So when he stood up, he sang a song instead of giving his acceptance speech. And I was thinking about this while I was listening to Reza Ramazani in the previous session. He and I are both economists. We look at the same sources and have many same views. I will not subject you to a song, but I will probably reiterate a bunch of things that he had to say. The United States has a history of trade wars, and you'd think at some level that we would have learned. The second cultural and last cultural reference I'll make is to Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Ben Stein was a teacher in that movie. He's also a PhD economist, and he asked the students the question: Smoot-Hawley Trade Act, lowered, raised tariffs? Anyone? Smoot-Hawley, lowered, raised, anyone? I don't think he got an answer. The answer is that it raised tariffs very significantly on about 20,000 different goods. And I'll make the claim that was sort of our last big trade war. What we're doing now is more like that trade war than a bunch of skirmishes that we've had in the interim. We had a pasta skirmish, we had a banana skirmish, we had a chicken skirmish, and we had skirmishes with Japan. None of those sort of raised to the level at which we're taking the trade war today. I did mention that we had history, and before the Smoot-Hawley Trade Act back in 1828, we also initiated a trade war. So we seem to be doing it about every 100 years, 1828, 1929, and now 2019. We're a little bit early, but it doesn't seem to be stopping our president. The fact that we do have a history of it doesn't mean that it's a good idea. It means that we probably should have learned from our prior experience. The Smoot-Hawley Trade Act reduced our international trade by about 50%. And I don't think that there's uniform consensus on the notion, but it's highly likely that the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was responsible for a significant proportion of the Great Depression, at least adding significantly to the depths of the Great Depression. Okay, so that's a little bit of a history. What are we doing now? As I mentioned, what we're doing now is sort of more like Smoot-Hawley, but still on a smaller scale than the pasta, bananas, chicken, or Japan skirmishes. We started out by putting protecting the solar panel and washing machine industries. We then moved on to steel and aluminum. Moved on to cars. Now, the cars were just a threat. We never actually put protections on automobiles, which is a good thing because estimates are that had we done that, we would have lost about 4,400 jobs in the automotive sector. And then we moved on to China. Right? We moved away from industries and moved very specifically to China. China. Over the course of 2018, we put tariffs on the vast majority, if not all, of Chinese imports into the United States, and they in turn put tariffs on the vast majority of U.S. exports to China. We're currently in a little bit of a state of limbo because President Trump had threatened to increase significantly our tariffs on Chinese imports in early 2019 if the Chinese hadn't given in to our demands. They have not, and we have not, partly I think because President Trump is getting a lot of feedback from businesses in the U.S. that, you know, let's not double down on this. It's doing enough damage already. Why now? I think in the last session there was a big discussion of geopolitical reasons. I'm an economist. I could wax about the geopolitical reasons, but I don't have expertise, so I'll refrain. And I will lead it to a bunch of the reasons that have been given. One, I think President Trump is genuinely averse to trade deficits of any size, but he's particularly displeased with the trade deficit that we have with China. If you are displeased with trade deficits, China is a good target. In 2017, of our $566 billion trade deficit, China accounted for $376 billion of it. Right? So China is a big carrier of our trade deficit. Now, you might expect that with all of President Trump's efforts in 2018, that perhaps our trade deficit with China might have gone down. Turns out that's not the case. It increased from $376 billion up to $419 billion. At the same time that our overall trade deficit also increased substantially from $566 billion up to $621 billion. Right, this begs the question of, oh my goodness, if we are imposing all of these barriers, why is the trade deficit still going on? The answer is that the trade deficit really has little or nothing to do with trade protections, with IP, with dumping, with safeguards, with anything that you talk about with respect to trade. A little bit. All of that stuff nibbles around the edges. But the big deal with respect to the trade deficit is savings in the United States. And the big deal with savings in the United States is the federal budget deficit. Right, our federal budget deficit increased by about a little over $100 billion between 2017 and 2018, and that's why our trade deficit increased. Right? Okay. Well, how does that work? Well, our trade deficit is a mirror image of our trade in financial instruments. Right? When the U.S. runs a budget deficit, the U.S. is going to be selling treasuries to foreigners. They're going to buy treasuries in dollars, but they have to buy dollars. The current currency appreciates, so we're going to import more, we're going to export less. And so financial instruments, they're the mirror image. The bigger our deficits, the lower is our savings, the bigger is our trade deficit going to be. It's actually that simple. It doesn't have to do with tariffs. It doesn't have to do with the other excuses that we're giving for really hammering China. And I'm not going to say that these excuses aren't valid. They are all problems. One is intellectual property, right? There's no question that China is disregarding our intellectual property rights. Currency manipulation. I think there's little question that China is manipulating its currency to make its exports relatively cheap. Low wages. I don't think this is a conscious effort on the part of the Chinese, but their wages are very low. We often talk about China with respect to dumping, right? That's selling exports in a market at below cost. Some disagreement over whether or not they're doing that. Subsidies. There are also very heavy subsidies in China for any industries where they export to us. So there's a laundry list of reasons why we're addressing China, of which the trade deficit is probably the worst. And you might also question whether or not imposing all these trade barriers is a good idea, and I'll talk to that for a little bit. One is, what response do we get, right, when we initiate a trade war? Well, the most obvious response we get is that there's retaliation. Right? China has put tariffs on our exports in the same way that we have tariffs on theirs. The other way that countries retaliate, and that economists will often indicate that we should be retaliating, or the U.S. should be pursuing its goals in trade, is through the World Trade Organization. Right? The problem is that the U.S. doesn't really believe in dispute settlement in the World Trade Organization because it sometimes rules against us. Right? And so we starve it of the judges that are necessary to adjudicate cases. We can talk more about that, but maybe later. Right, and the other is diversion. Right, the Chinese government is responsible for buying airplanes. It's not clear that the Chinese government hasn't made a decision to buy from Airbus or another supplier and not Boeing because of what the United States is doing. So we get a negative response. We also impose costs on ourselves. Right? Contrary to what I think President Trump would like you to believe, the Chinese are not paying the tariffs. Right? We pay the tariffs. Consumers in the United States, we pay the tariffs. And it comes at a cost. Because of, and that raises prices, and it reduces economic activity in the United States, we've foregone about $3 billion worth of taxes, not tariffs, but tax revenue from other activity. We've foregone about $8 billion worth of economic activity. Now, those aren't big numbers in a $20 trillion economy. But we're giving it up to pursue these goals, and might we be able to pursue them some other way that doesn't give up quite so much. Let's talk, I'm going to say the same thing that Reza did and talk a little bit about the steel industry, right? He made the point that our steel industry tariffs are working, and they are if you only care about the steel industry, right? Because we're created about 2,400 jobs, as he pointed out, at about a cost of about $650,000 per job. Right. And what wasn't pointed out in the previous session but I think is really important is that's $650,000 per year. Right? It's not just we bought that job for $650,000, we got to buy it again next year. So it's a very expensive way of creating jobs. Prices have gone up in the steel industry. Prices have gone up commensurate with the tariffs, and aluminum prices have gone up. And that affects all of the producers of other things, automobiles, beer cans, everything else that uses steel and aluminum. It raises their cost of doing business, and it creates job loss in those industries. It's been estimated that if we were to launch into a full-scale trade war, we could, in fact, cost ourselves up to about 4 million jobs. I want to talk just a little bit about soybeans. Much is made of the 4.2% GDP growth that we had in the second quarter of 2018. Little known fact and surprising fact is that 0.6 of that was increased soybean exports to China, right? Because we had pre-announced, or the Chinese had pre-announced the tariffs that they were going to put on soybean imports. So what all of our soybean producers did was they gathered up all of the soybeans they could find, put them on boats, airplanes, cars, trucks, whatever they could find, and got them over to China. Right. So that's part of the 4.2. That's part of the impact that these tariffs can have. Right. Very impactful on the industries that they touch. As well as the diversion of contracts like Boeing that I mentioned, their supply chains can be irreparably altered. Right, Chinese importers of U.S. products are going to find other countries to import them from. And when the tariffs are gone, they're not necessarily going to come back to the United States. So it's not a matter of, oh, we can toss these tariffs on, and then we'll take them off, and everything will go back to the way that it was. No, there are long-living costs. I'm told now probably less than 30 seconds left, so I'll get moving. I will leave it with the three primary impacts from an economic perspective. One is that it raises prices in the industries that are to be protected. And that's intended, and that's helpful to that industry. But it also raises prices for all of the other industries in the United States, in steel and aluminum. We have many more people employed in steel and aluminum using industries than in steel. It raises prices to consumers. Right, not only to producers who use those inputs, but to all of us, it raises prices. And finally, it alienates other countries. There's a long history of the World WTO, the GATT, some people call the General Agreement to Talk and Talk, but we've had a long history of cooperation in reducing trade barriers on a multilateral basis. And I think that all of this bilateral, all of this industry-specific tariff war that we're pursuing is putting the potential for any more multilateral activity really on hold for quite some time. And that's detrimental to not only U.S. economic growth, but global economic growth. Okay, thank you.
Good morning to all of you. Let me say at the outset, it's a real honor to have been invited back to CWA for the second time. Very eclectic and interesting conference. I'm astonished at how many people are in this room. both because of the weather and given the other very interesting events that are here. Thank you for your attention. One disclaimer, I accepted this invitation before I was called back to government service. Nothing that I say in any way represents the policies of the United States government. I don't speak for the U.S. government except when I'm overseas in the capacities that I'm engaged in. Let me sort of start, take the way John did, with a little bit of audience participation. Could I just see a show of hands? How many of you here have ever been a trade negotiator? How many of you have negotiated a trade? Bought a car? A house? Gone to a market? Okay. How many of you buy imports? How many of you, one way or another, through your employment, through somebody you know, benefit more or less directly from American exports? Somewhat fewer. How many might have lost a job or believe they lost a job because of imports? Couple? Got a job? In an industry that America is successful in, where we export, the jobs came through that? A few. Okay. So the takeaway is, I think, at least on the import-export side, I think a lot, and especially on the import side, a lot of recognition of how important trade is to our way of life and to our culture. So John did a great job of kind of laying out most, if not all, of the important basic elements that I think we want to try to address, and Nancy will pick up on some of the social and labor items. I'll provide a somewhat different kind of context, or start with a different kind of context. Go back to a book I read a number of years ago called 1493. It's by an anthropological historian named Charles Mann, who writes about the impact that the discovery of the Americas and the opening of the Americas had on the world economy. And there's a very interesting chapter in this book where he writes about the trade that developed in the aftermath of the discovery, the opening up, the exploitation of the resources of the Americas. By 1570, 80 years after the after Columbus discovered America, there was, centered on Manila, and a very lively trade that involved a couple of times a year dozens and dozens of Chinese ships loaded with merchandise and traders, and dozens of Spanish galleons that had set sail from Latin America loaded with gold and especially with silver, where they conducted a lively trade in Chinese manufactures. Sound familiar? The goods, among them silk, porcelain, iron, chairs, roof tiles, cotton, sugar, flour, horses, cattle. Even one writer at the time writes little figures of baby Jesus. The Chinese were making in the 16th and 17th century to hawk to European buyers. What's really interesting about this is the terms of trade, the price. The Chinese were buying silver. Think of that as what was going on here. They paid twice as much in goods as the European sellers of gold and silver could get in Europe. Europe, coming out of the Middle Ages, woefully underdeveloped, especially it was an artisan culture. It couldn't compete in any way, shape, or form. And that 16th, 17th, early 18th century trade between basically Europe or Latin America, Europe and China produced effects that were profound and may look familiar. European artisans and manufacturers competing with Chinese producers were driven out of business. Fast forward maybe a century to the Industrial Revolution, which owes in part to that this overwhelming competition that that European producers faced. The Chinese, awash in silver, faced all kinds of internal economic and other problems. But with all this silver, they saw no real need to change. They didn't. And at least according to some historians, China's long decline begins in the aftermath of, or in this, late in this period. And I think, to me, that kind of reminds us a little bit about the dynamics of trade, the impact that things, relationships can have over a very long period of time, that are important to think about as we embark on trade wars, try to protect our interests. Efforts were made to try to control this Chinese trade, and it was like a river, could not be stopped. Make four other points. We do trade because consumers benefit from competition, from lower prices, from greater availability of goods, greater variety of goods. We all go to the supermarket, they're jammed, those of my generation, they're jammed with stuff that was not in any way, shape, or form available when I was growing up, except in season. Now it's available year-round. But we recognize there are contrary pressures. We want to consume, but we want to produce. And have developed a system where we have trade agreements and we try to trade things off. You know, you can have this and we'll get that. Those trade-offs being an integral part of the international trading system. It's what I, as a trade negotiator, did in the failed negotiations for the free trade of the Americas 10 or 15, 20 years ago now. And it's in a sense, it's the questioning, if not in some cases the violation of those trade-offs or the questioning of those trade-offs, questioning especially by the present U.S. government, that lead to the trade wars that we have. Second point, every country in the world has things that it protects in these trade-offs. The United States historically has protected steel, citrus, sugar, the aviation industry, financial services, and we've tried, without a whole lot of success, to protect jobs. But when we strike these balances, then in implementing the agreements, one needs to be cognizant of the benefits of trade, but also not to be wimpy when other countries violate the deals that were done. And in a sense, that's part of what the U.S. government is doing now, not being wimpy when China systematically violates the agreements that it struck with the United States and with others on joining the WTO. So, at least at a high level of generality, it is right and appropriate to go after them. The administration, the U.S. government over the years, and the present administration is no different, uses a variety of tools to go after areas where we think we're being cheated, just as other governments go after us, by the way, when they accuse us of violating the rules. The multilateral route that John referred to, headlines in the New York Times a day or two ago, Office of U.S. Trade Representative preparing punitive duties that it expects will become an option, shall we say, for the United States government when a ruling is published by the WTO that European governments have illegally subsidized Airbus to the detriment of American economic interests in the form of Boeing. Using that multilateral tool has been a central piece. A lot of frustration. It takes a long time. By the time you get a judgment, the original problem has either gone away or transmogrified so substantially that it's no longer relevant. But also very important. And then the bilateral one, going after individual countries. The same strategies we use to open markets. Multilateral negotiations, form of the Uruguay round, Doha round. Those negotiations kind of come to a stop because it's been impossible to strike agreements. Regional agreements, the FTAA that I was part of, reflect that. NAFTA and now the U.S. MCA, part of that, European Union free trade agreements with on a regional basis around the world, and bilateral free trade agreements, which we're now working on or looking at with a whole host of countries, improving the one we have with Korea, improving the one we have with Singapore, looking at new ones with a variety of other countries. So why don't I stop there? We can get into some of the specifics. Thank you all very much.
Nancy? Good morning. As I was listening to my colleagues, I was thinking about, you know, why do we even have trade wars? And there are a lot of reasons, some of which you addressed. But fundamentally, as our globe has gone through massive social impacts from globalization, not just trade, but also globalization, as you are well aware, we've had a rise of resistance, unhappiness with trade, opposition because of job loss, job export to other countries, and an unfair and uneven impact of trade and globalization around the world. So that's pretty much recognized by everyone. And the question for a couple decades at least has been what to do about that. What to do. And so I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what the U.S. is doing, what the ILO is doing. Some time ago, the WTO basically said, we're not going to oversee or regulate labor issues. They just said it's not in our mandate. And so that left a gap of what to do, since that is one of the biggest areas of impact because of trade and globalization, as well as environmental impacts. And so for the last 25, almost 30 years, trade agreements that the U.S. has negotiated, the EU, and now almost every regional agreement address labor standards and environmental standards in some way. So NAFTA did it in a very low-key way, and it was a side agreement. But fast forward to TPP and everything else in between, those kinds of negotiations have improved and improved and improved in terms of the specific expectations that the U.S. has with its trading partners. Fundamentally, it's based on the Declaration on Fundamental Rights at Work, which say, and this is in the trade agreements, core labor standards. Every trading partner with the U.S., and this is also in the trade preference legislation, which I'll talk to you about in a minute.
Speak louder into the microphone.
Okay, I'll have to pull it up. Sorry, I didn't want to have it block my face. Okay. You can't have slave labor producing your goods that you're exporting. You can't have child labor. You have to have some freedom of association and a right to collective bargaining. You can't have, without addressing it, discrimination, addressing any of these, discrimination based on gender in job category or jobs. And those are the fundamental core labor standards that are coming out of the ILO. Every member country, 187 member countries, must be working on and aspiring to achieving that. So fundamentally, those issues, which is not the U.S. position, but the International Labor Organization, which is a tripart organization made up of business, labor, and governments, have set fundamental basement standards about what we really expect of our member countries. And so what the U.S. has done and the EU, as they have further developed their values coming into trade agreements and trade preference structures, is they expect a fundamental fairness in the labor context and also protection on impact against corruption in terms of the EU and on environmental standards. So that's been a very interesting side of this discussion. It doesn't mean that when Americans lose jobs that those same Americans are going to get the new jobs that come in. So it doesn't solve every problem. But it does has created a real dialogue and some real change around the world that is continues as we speak in terms of how trading partners are going to be dealing with each other. Now, in the last administration, that became very specific as to many, many countries. And I want to give you one example just to give you an idea. So while the U.S. is not, well, the ILO is not an organization that is a police, a law enforcement agency. It's a standard-setting organization where there are commitments by countries to have higher standards in the world of work. The U.S. has used, and the EU and other countries have used trade and development as levers to both benefit developing and emerging economies, but also expect better standards. And so there's in addition to trade agreements, which include that, there's a general system of preferences and then some regional laws that create trade preferences that allow countries to benefit with a lower tariff or better competition compared to other countries. So there's a law called AGOA, which it applies to the sub-Saharan African countries. And it's one of the few laws from the U.S. that gives a trade preference for the garment industry. There's another law, the HOPE II, which was just for Haiti in the similar way. So what the U.S. has done is brought ILO in as a partner with its African trading partners to assist both the U.S. and its trading partners in this context to improve their labor standards and their working conditions and bring decent work there. So what could possibly motivate the countries? Well, it's if they might lose their trade preference. And that hasn't happened that much. It's sort of not happened in some ways, which is a problem, because if you don't have any accountability, it doesn't happen in the same way. But in the last some years, there's a country called Swaziland. Anyone ever heard of that? The last absolute monarchy in sub-Saharan Africa, a really, really odd, interesting country. But they had an incredible amount of laws that restricted freedom of association, freedom of speech, any unions even being formed. And after some years of dialogue with the U.S., the U.S. pulled their trade preference for garments and everything else that is covered in AGOA. And here are the things. So the ILO came in and did a study about what was wrong, fundamentally violating those fundamental core labor standards. And they had a Patriot Act-like law that said if anybody is in a protest or has a T-shirt on that questions the government, they can be thrown in jail. They had no allowing of registration of labor unions to have legitimacy to bargain. They had a Public Order Act that basically said no rights of association or assembly or speech to whole sectors of their economy. And the ILO basically came in as an independent agency and said, these violate core labor standards, period. And so the U.S. used that as a way to pull their status. Well, a big part of their economy is exporting garments, and maybe 15,000 workers at least, and it's not a big country. So the business and the labor and the governments and also a lot of help from the South African constitutional lawyers started working on passing laws and changing it and literally changing the context in the country. And what's important about this is not just what happened in Swaziland. What's important is every sub-Saharan African country watched this process happen because they said, what if this happens to us? And they were very worried about it. What I want to say is by the time they finished passing laws and made a lot of progress on this over a few years, and their economy, it's a very poor country, their economy suffered. In January of 2018, the U.S. restored their trade preference because they made that many changes. That's happening in many countries around the world. TPP brought forward Vietnam, which was one of the most important countries to get back into the community of nations with basic labor standards. It's a very important and very useful process that was started and that continues. It's not about trade wars, though. It's about how are the community of nations going to use trade, use values and standards to address these issues. And I just want to say the EU is a wonderful partner to the U.S. on these issues. They have a different system, and so sometimes the two major economies, you know, the U.S. economy and the EU economy, can leverage against each other to influence their trading partner countries in different ways. And so there's a lot of cooperation. So I hope you'll be interested in more about this, but I probably should stop.
Okay. Thank you so much. Now I'd like to give a few minutes so the panelists can respond to one another and have a little dialogue on their introduction.
Great. Thank you. So just a couple of things. First, thank you for the 1493 reference. If I didn't think it was rude, I would have ordered it right here. The point was made that there are things that countries protect. EU agriculture is big, and U.S. steel is all mentioned. And I want to just build on that by saying that probably the best way to liberalize trade is to just stay away from those things. Right, go after areas where countries might be willing to give. Right, if we've been going after the EU on ag for a really long time, and we haven't made much progress. It's pushing on a string; it's a fool's errand. So let's turn to places where we can make progress. Another comment is that also point was made that bilateral agreements are a good idea, and I agree wholeheartedly. And that fits in with the category of let's get benefits where we can find them. So I think that the TPP was a real missed opportunity. I think that it was shoved aside because it was negotiated by the previous administration, and I think that from a trade policy perspective, that was a misstep that I don't fully understand the purpose of. I want to talk just for a second again about WTO dispute, and there's lots of talk about how the dispute mechanism there is slow and takes time. Are you all familiar with sort of the notion of starving the beast as it pertains to the federal government, right? You reduce taxes, take away revenues, so then it does a bad job because it doesn't have the resources to do a good job, and you say, oh, look, the government's doing a bad job, let's take away more revenues. That's a game that we're playing with the WTO dispute resolution system. There are supposed to be 7 judges, and the U.S., and this is not just this president, but the previous president, we've been vetoing new judges being appointed to the court to the point where there are now 4 by the end of September, there will be 3 by the end of December. If we don't allow another one, there will be 2, essentially rendering the court not very helpful and certainly not very timely. I want to make the point that I think the conversation that we're having here is much less important than it seems. It's much less important because part of what's driving this conversation is that trade is such a big job disruptor, dislocator. And I will argue that over the course of the last 20, 30 years, yes, trade has grown a lot, but technology has had a much bigger impact on jobs, has had a much bigger impact on the people in poorer states, the people living in Appalachia, those who are looking to President Trump to bring their jobs back through trade. Trade is a bit of a whipping boy in this case. It's trying pay no attention to this issue over here that I can't do anything about. Pay attention to trade. So as a force of social change and social impact, I think that technology has been much more serious than trade. That's it. Thank you.
I'll just pick up a little bit on what John referred to, what Nancy was talking about, jobs and job loss. I remember the 1992 presidential election campaign when my namesake, Ross Perot, talked about a giant sucking sound, jobs moving to Mexico if we entered into a free trade agreement and a NAFTA with it. And there has been job loss, absolutely. And there have been job gains from American industries that have been able to develop export markets in Mexico and, of course, also in Canada. The Peterson Institute did a study a couple of years ago of how many jobs got lost. came there in the net loss, the gains, or the losses minus the gains. And their figure came to something like 330,000 jobs lost over 20 years. That comes out to about 15,000 jobs a year. I don't remember the exact figure. I think but in the New York Times a few days ago was reported 130,000 new jobs added to the U.S. economy in must have been March or maybe February. 15,000 a year, in a macro sense, not really a big deal. Obviously, it has impact locally in specific towns, cities, states, in specific industries. That creates political pressures. Politicians have to respond to that. That's the way our system works. I was part of a discussion about NAFTA 20 years on that took place in Minneapolis a couple years ago. Carla Hills, the U.S. Trade Representative at the time who negotiated this, was there. And someone asked, is there anything you think you didn't get right? And, of course, she'd given a long, a thumping defense of the good work that they'd done and the great results that it produced. But when she was asked this question, she said, you know, when we got the agreement done, we were done, and we left. And we didn't stay focused on jobs, on job retraining, on the job and local political implications that flowed out of NAFTA. And she didn't say this, but to some extent, we're reaping the cost of that failure today.
Nancy, do you have any comments?
Yes. So one of the things that ILO is a research institution and we're charged with looking at what helps economies around the world become more robust or what stalls them and the role of trade and technology and all these other areas. And so there are many effects that are not just absolute jobs lost or created. And it also depends on the industries you're talking about. But trade is about the flow of goods and services. And let me just mention, by the way, that the wages in China have been rising and rising and rising. And so a lot of manufacturing has been moving to other, mostly Asian countries, but other places around the world because of the growing middle class in China, interestingly. And so that you see these things going on. It's the uneven impacts that makes it more politically sensitive. No matter how many good stories are told, including by the Peterson Institute, Americans and other populations around the world are not convinced that trade is good for us. And that's a bad thing. Open trade and open societies are the future. It's a very important thing. I actually think bilateral trade agreements are too static and going to be things in the past, because multilateral trade agreements, strengthening regions, strengthening alliances, are actually going to become more and more important. We learned that from watching TPP, which was supposed to create an edge against China. And so the inconsistent policies of this administration have not helped. But what we saw on the labor standards and TPP, as we were preparing to help the countries that really needed to do some work to just be at the basement level, was that they were influencing each other. Now, Vietnam got interested. Japan was helping Vietnam and Myanmar because they have such a strong presence there in their trading relationships, and they saw that they needed to work with other countries. So it wasn't just about the U.S. by any means. It's as there are multilateral negotiations, countries start to pay attention to each other in regions. And so there are a lot of good effects. And I favor certainly multilateral trade agreements because of that.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for your comments. I'm going to move to some questions now. And I think one thing of interest is there are countries that will benefit from this problem with China and the United States and this trade war, mostly mentioning Japan, Canada, but there are some other ones that are can gain, and that's Brazil, Philippines, Vietnam. Could all of you or one of you respond to that impact that this is going to have for other countries, smaller countries, on their trade?
Absolutely right. Countries that are sort of left out of the fray. You know, Brazil is an important one. I mentioned soybeans, right? I mean, the Chinese aren't going to be buying soybeans from the United States, but they're going to be buying soybeans from everybody else who produces soybeans. So that will be a benefit to the other countries. It does provide opportunities, and as I mentioned, it also, you know, they're not only short-term opportunities, but long-term opportunities, because these sorts of barriers, temporary though they may be, will have more long-term lasting implications.
Nancy? Okay, we have one student question that I think, Nancy, you have addressed, but I'll give you a chance to respond a little bit more if you'd like. Do you know why the NTA refuses to deal with labor issues in a greater detail?
Trade agreements are policy and politics. So without being specific about that agreement, it is an important instrument for managing relationships, and also there are limits depending on the priorities of the governments. And so labor has been a priority up and down depending on how strongly the populace cares about things. President Trump has made a big fuss about companies bringing back some of their manufacturing in certain areas of the country, and usually that seems to turn out to be very expensive per job, as Ross mentioned. So, and obviously you're here because you're interested in trade. Pay attention to the politics. Pay attention to who's opposed to it and to how the policies are evolved because of that. It's going to be an evolving thing for the foreseeable future. So that's kind of a vague answer, but don't think that there's just this good policy and that bad policy. It all has to do with the relationship of all the parties involved.
And so the NTA was the NTA?
I think that's the new NAFTA.
Oh.
And actually, the new NAFTA has much better labor provisions, many of which came out of TPP, than the original NAFTA, to be fair.
Great, thank you. I think this for all of you. If tariffs aren't the best way to get China to reform, then what are the best alternatives?
I'm not going to say that tariffs aren't the best way. But I'm going to say that the way that we're going about it is not the best way. Because of what we've done to the dispute settlement in the WTO, maybe that's not feasible anymore. But in theory, that is the better way to do it on a multilateral basis, to do it with the backing of the rest of the international trade community, not just going out on our own and saying, oh, you're bad and we're going to hammer you. But the dispute settlement mechanism, if it rules in our favor, would say, yes, go ahead and impose tariffs. So that would be the preferred method.
I would add to strengthen the point about the WTO. Many other countries share exactly the same concerns that we have about China's systematic violation of its WTO commitments, and so partnering with a lot of other countries in bringing a case to the WTO, as we have been doing over the last 6 or 7 years at least, is and ought to be a growth industry, but in coalition with others, and obviously there's some staffing and other problems with WTO that need to go along with that. Part of the original impetus behind TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was to write the rules of freer trade in the Asia-Pacific region as that China was deliberately left out of, mm-hmm. as a way to pressure China to to liberalize its own markets so it could be part of something bigger that would be of advantage to it. So TPP was leveraged to try to help get China where we would like it to be in terms of open markets, in terms of adherence to its commitments. Unfortunately, that lever has been lost. But I think that the problem of China will be one of the reasons why something like TPP will in all likelihood come back on the agenda at some point in the future.
And it was interesting in the beginning of the new administration and when they decided that TPP was not going to be pursued, they said to Japan, well, let's just do a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Japan. And Japan said, no, we're going to sign the TPP, as did the other countries. So our advanced countries are dealing with each other differently in some ways. Just a thought.
Okay, this is, I think, a pretty general question to all three of you. I appreciate the economic, social, and political reasons for trade agreements. Please give suggestions on how the goods manufactured in countries that produce major environmental damage should be managed, the impact on pollution, things of that nature.
Well, let me just say that that is for at least the EU and has been in the past for the U.S. a subject for negotiation. And it is also subject to other regulation and other standards around the world. So it's an imperfect and incomplete system, but there's a great deal of focus on it. An example that isn't in trade, but that's really important, is how the World Bank is being held accountable, partly by its own new commitments around climate change, to look at their deep investments and also their work with the private sector as to environmental impacts. And the new World Bank president, who was nominated by the U.S., is an experienced guy, started 2 days ago, and the first thing he said was that the World Bank was going to pursue their existing policy on climate change, which is not at all something that the U.S. supports, but clearly he's going to be advancing that because of the world consensus. So there are a lot of ways that regulations and commitments among countries are being advanced, but it doesn't mean that there aren't terrible degradation situations that have happened because of the nature of the sector or because of the lack of enforcement.
I might add, all of the trade agreements that the United States has negotiated since NAFTA have included strong chapters on the environment that one way or another have aimed to impose some requirements on the countries we're negotiating with to adhere to certain environmental standards in their course of their economic development. I would note, in most cases, other governments have a strong dislike of this. Mm-hmm. It basically amounts to the United States telling them how to run their internal affairs, an infringement on their sovereignty. We know how those arguments work in this country, and it's not any different there. The benefit for them of making those commitments is they get improved access to the American market, which is kind of interesting. So we're generally able to get somewhere. The chapters, in the eyes of certainly many in the environmental community in the United States, are weaker than they ought to be, but they are a new feature of international trade that really has developed and become much stronger just in the course of the last 25 years or so.
Yeah, I'll add, I confess to not having thought this through really, really carefully, but in terms of at least climate change, stepping away from the Paris Accord is another misstep. Because if we participate in that and we can get countries with which we trade, with whom we have issues surrounding their environmental policies, that's one way, as outside of the trade arena, but that's one way of, to some extent, leveling the playing field.
OK, Okay, great. Thank you. The UN Conference on Trade and Development has said trade disputes, common concern is around the unavoidable impact on the still fragile global economy, particularly on developing commodity-rich countries that are dependent on exports. If you could speak to that.
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. The UN Conference on Trade and Development has stated the common concern is around the unavoidable impact on the still fragile global economy, particularly on developing commodity-rich countries that are dependent on exports.
So I'll speak to that. So an example of there are many examples, but an example of that are the oil-rich countries whose economies tend to become dependent on basically one export. And that's a huge vulnerability because if you think about what's happened around energy, its rise and fall in terms of importance has been very devastating even to the Russian economy or to some of these countries who are oil dependent. And that's a phenomenon in development called the oil curse. Because what all countries need are diverse economies based on diverse export as well as diverse economic activity internally and regionally. And so this is something, I'm not the economist at the table, but this is something that our institution works on. And now that we've lived through the Great Recession, and now that the IMF yesterday said unless we adjust some of our economic policies around the world and we have vulnerabilities, another shock may come in the next 2 years. And this issue of how integrated the economy is globally and how vulnerable countries are, and the commodities is a part of that, I would say, is a very important thing that the global community is looking at.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with all of that. And if you think that the trade wars are rising to any are likely to rise to anywhere near sort of the Smoot-Hawley level, then yes, developing resource-rich countries are going to be very vulnerable. As our economies shrink, our demand for oil, for instance, shrinks. The price of oil falls. It can lead to a lot of volatility in those countries. So I think that's expressing the view, perhaps of you know, there's a bad thing going on here, and let's not let it get out of control, because there are countries that will be on the sidelines and very vulnerable.
Yes. Okay, we have a student question here. How important / influential is U.S. involvement in ILO policy?
Oh. the U.S. is a very important country to the ILO and to every U.N. agency. 22% of the U.N. budget and 22% of the ILO budget is funded by the U.S., and that's based on the size of your GDP. And just to say, the ILO was created before the UN. It was created in the Versailles Treaty as one of the peace efforts to address the major crises after World War I. And the ILO was brought together, workers, labor, and business, and governments, to figure out how to work together as partners in the economy to do reconstruction in Europe. And that was a really foundational thing. But as an institution, ILO was created with the idea in 1919, 100 years ago, that economic and social justice have to be a part of any economic equation if you want peace, period. And still today, that's an extremely relevant thing. So at the time when it was not created like a general UN, everybody has a vote institution. It was created more like a G20 in the sense that the economies of largest importance have permanent seats at the ILO. And then there's a rotating for smaller economies. And so in the case of the U.S. actually has three seats, permanent seats on the governing body of the ILO. One is held by the AFL-CIO, one is held by the U.S. Council for International Business, and the third is held by the U.S. government. The Labor Secretary represents the government, but the State Department and the U.S. Labor Department work together in managing that critical responsibility. And well beyond that, the U.S., with its value systems and its laws, is very influential in helping get good international labor standards and standards for the world of work moving forward. So, and I was the, I'm retired now, but I was the representative of the ILO to the United States and Canada, both workers, business, and the government, as well as the World Bank and others. So that was my job. So I always say it's really important.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, we...
It's called International Labor Organization, but it's not a union. It's right. It is a UN agency.
Okay, we have about 7 minutes left, and there are quite a few questions around intellectual property theft and how can the U.S. address that with trade grievances or laws? Where do you see that going in the next decade?
So this is not an area of expertise for me. But I think that putting pressure on China through economic incentives is the only way to address the intellectual property issue. That said, I think that we have to weigh the costs of putting that economic pressure, certainly in the way that we're doing it now, against the benefits. The benefits certainly are not trivial, but they are small relative to the costs that we're incurring right now. So I at some level, I question the legitimacy of really going after it with full guns blazing.
The U.S. government does go after IP at full guns blazing, whether it's wise or not, and including because intellectual property represents one of our comparative advantages in international trade. That's how we talk about trade, where the comparative advantage may lie is going to drive trade. So the U.S. government has quite vigorously acted in foreign countries through our trade agreements and just through the day-to-day diplomacy that we're engaged in to foster effective laws to strengthen intellectual property protection and to make sure that those are enforced. Whether the issue is counterfeit goods that in effect are stolen or the intellectual property behind them stolen from their American or other producers for that matter. Patent protection, again, protecting the rights of the owner, the creator of an original good from being abused in a foreign country, protecting recordings. Now, in the digital age, protecting recordings is a little bit different than it used to be, but that is also film rights, music rights. Those are definitely areas of American comparative advantage that are important to protect. Software. Another. This is an issue that I've addressed in Georgia, where an industry estimate 83% of the software used by businesses and government in the country is pirated, shall we say, mostly to the detriment of Microsoft and Oracle. Maybe you like or don't like Microsoft and Oracle, but the theft of American property ought to concern us. And so all of the trade agreements that we conclude, either they have some combination of upfront requirement, governments must do A, B, C, D, and E before we will even open negotiations with you on a free trade agreement. And then, X, Y, Z, and a whole bunch of other letters as part of the package to conclude it. It's big business, and it's important to the American economy.
Yeah.
Can I say one thing?
Actually, if I could defend myself just a little bit, I don't disagree with anything that was just said. But I think that the current trade war, to the extent that it's fueled by IP protection, is terribly misguided. That's my only correction.
I want to say something separate. I once was in a debate with the guy from Microsoft in Washington who said, 90% of our product is pirated in some places in the world. And so that's a pretty serious thing, as Ross said. So And here's my response to him. I believe that we have to stand for and fight for and negotiate for fair trade, just like we have to do the same for democratic principles and democracies. And if we're not out there saying it, no matter how much erosion on it there is, there's going to be less of it. And in many cases, and in the last 10 years it's been debatable, we've made progress because we have taken a stand and we've negotiated for and we've had fights over both democracies and democratic principles and fair trade. So there's absolutely no way we can just step back from that, in my view, and I do see it make a difference around the world.
Okay, any further comments from any of you? John, Ross, and Nancy, we're so happy to have you at Conference on World Affairs, and we appreciate your expertise, and thank you for being here.